Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. And we're continuing our conversation right now with Brian Barlow, former general manager of WICN, who really ushered the station through the big transition to what we are today. And we're continuing our discussion about all the things that happened at that period. It was an amazing period. Talk to me about Jazz at Sunset. When did that, do you know anything about when that started?
Yeah, that started,
And you're still working on Jazz at Sunset, I want to mention.
Ironically, yes. No, Jack Wertheimer started Jazz at Sunset. He had a connections at Equitarium. I don't remember the exact year. I would say roughly around 1990 or so it probably started. And it grew up pretty fast. But eventually, we wanted to get into a little more contemporary sound, a little more fun party. So I took it over, and I don't remember. That was probably 20 years ago. I don't remember. And we kept it going until the Equitarium no longer wanted to have it on campus because they didn't have any room for it any longer. And we struggled for a while to get it out there, but we had wonderful shows, 10 shows every summer with some of the biggest names in jazz and other musical forums. And we were blessed to see this thing every Friday, packed with families and kids. And
it was a whole thing.
It was a thing. It was a good thing. We loved doing it. Of course, we had the Brown Bags too at the same time.
Did you start the Brown Bags?
Oh, no. Gene Pettit did that.
Gene Pettit. But that became a sort of appointment event. Like you would mark your calendar, and we would have a whole calendar of stuff for that.
Well, yeah, we used to do 15 of them at one point in time. And people came, some people, big stars started there, like Karen Allison.
That's right.
Jim Brickman, the New Age star. Also, Alison Krauss was one of them way back when she was 14 as a violinist was there. So it was a proving ground for those people. But a lot of people who can't go out at night, seniors and people who have disabilities, would come to this thing and give them that one outlet to see real live music. So that was a nice thing to see. And then they're still going on. They've shrunk the amount. I don't know what the number is today, right. 5 or 6 maybe. So those were staples of our business. But I thought we could expand it further and use all the concert halls and bring in some acts.
And you did.
And we did.
Let's talk about some of the acts, because I saw some great acts here.
I first have to say I knew nothing about booking concerts. I'd never done it. But
well, one of the first things you learned is nobody will book you if you're within 40 miles or something of where they're already playing.
Well, I learned a lot from Fred Taylor, the great Fred Taylor. I called up one day, said, can you tell me how to do this? And he helped me a lot. It just be a few people. And I didn't know much still then. But eventually he called me one day and said, I have an act, Brian, I don't know what to do with. Maybe you want to take it. And I said, who is it? And he says, Bill Wyman's Rhythm Kings. And I said, all right. And I took a look at it, and then it was Georgie Fame. It was Gary Brooker from Procol Harum. It was, of course, Bill Wyman. It was Albert Lee on guitar. It was an all-star band. And I thought, all right. I wrote the contract right, and I did all the things right. I actually put a protection on. You have to protect your show. So generally you get 50 miles, 60 miles radius. No one can have a show for 30 days after and from now until then to perform, to protect yourself. And I did this. And the cool thing about that show is these guys had no place to go after they played Mohegan Sun and called me up and said, can come visit you at your house. And so at 11 in the morning, they pull up on the big bus, and there's Bill Wyman getting out and Gary Brooker coming out of the house. And I set up a barbecue for these guys. We hung out all day long with all these English people looking at their walls saying, what are these walls made out of? Because they said, it's chalk. And I said, what? They couldn't believe that. And then, geez, you got cookers. And I was burners. And we have 2. You have 6. And they go, you know, America. So it was a very exciting day.
I can't let the fact that Bill Wyman was at your house go.
Yeah.
Were you like as blown away as I am just listening to it, or were you just caught up into the moment?
Well,
that's like a freaky huge deal.
Well, Evan walked off the bus, said hello, went to the back of the house, not to the front. That's what they do in England, I guess. And then he walks out and says, hi, I'm Bill. And so I shake his hand, just a little guy. And I said, you know, hi, I'm Brian, and thanks. Come on to my house. And we walked in and talked. And he, you know, just explored these. Sorry, he had jukeboxes everywhere, so he wanted to check out the songs. And he loved, I think it was the 10 Commandments of Love.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that one. So he wanted me to play that for him. And, you know, it was a nice day, 5 or 6 hours before he had to race into the bus to get down for the sound check at all.
Were you used to meeting really famous
people? I only met Whitey Ford in my life, and that was it.
That's a big one, though.
Yeah, and Bobby Sherman, too.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, I did, yes. But oh, that's another story.
But did you, I mean, were you putting on a great front, and in the back of your mind, are you going like, oh, my God.
No, I was thrilled. This is great. This is like success to me. This is exciting.
And I mean, like meeting Pete Best, knowing you.
Yeah.
I can remember when he came down the station. That must have been a huge thing for you. And for those of you who don't know, Brian thinks he's a jazz person, but I know better that he's a British Invasion person, specifically the Beatles.
Well, I do love all that, too.
You don't just love that.
Yeah, I do love it, but I love jazz,
We've too. Gotten into hour-long conversations about...
But we have the joy of music, and we could have this thing happen at the station, you know? And Pete Best came. So the concerts went off really well, so I thought, let's do more of these things. What do I know? How are you going to fail now? Because we sold out the show and made a few dollars. And so I thought... Who can I get? I realized I had something I had to learn now. You have to have artists that haven't been here in a long time, like 5 years, who have some history of success.
Oh, interesting.
And so I thought of the Smothers Brothers. I don't know. I came up with it. Called William Morris. Didn't know me from anybody. And wanted to book them. Took a long time. But finally, we come to an agreement. And they came. But ironically, 9/11 had happened about a month before this.
9/11, yeah.
9/11, yeah. And it was tough times for the radio, what to play. It was all somber. So here they come into the Mechanics Hall.
Tough audience.
And people were laughing for the first time. And it was sold out.
I ended up interviewing, I forget which one of them.
Tommy. Yeah.
And he was amazing.
He's a very bright guy.
Really bright and knows a lot about political history.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole deal. I was unprepared for how intellectual he was.
He was. And ironically, after his show, I mean, it's kind of a funny thing to say, but when the brothers get on stage to do a sound check, they started to battle each other. Like, you wouldn't believe, swearing at each other and calling the family names. And I was, oh, my God, the show is over. So I went back there and said, I made a joke. How about if we make this a trio tonight? I'll stand between you and I'll pretend I'm playing and you guys can do this thing. They said, oh, no, we do this all the time. We go to marriage counseling, he said. And we learn to get it all out and walk away. I said, okay. And they did a great show. And then I spent all the night, 2 a.m. in the morning with Tommy, fighting about politics and life and old show stories from their Smothers Brothers show.
Oh, my God.
I said, this is a great thing. Let's bring in more acts, you know, keep doing this. And we made money on that one, too. So life was good here. We were starting to rock.
Do you think Worcester audiences are a good audience for something like that? You know, or you have to build an audience, too.
Worcester's a tough place to build.
First of all, it's tough to get people to go out.
Tough to go out. But not only that, you have to realize that there are called primary cities in the concert world. So if you have a big act, whoever that might be, they're going to probably play Boston, New York, Montreal. They'll never show up in Worcester because you have typically a 90-mile radius where you can't book them.
Right.
And Boston, of course, kills us every time. And if you choose Worcester or Boston for audience, you're going to get a lot more in Boston, make a lot more money, so we don't have a chance. So it was tricky to find the right acts that could make money.
You had to
money.
Find an act that was good, but not that good.
Yeah.
And by good, I mean famous.
And that's where jazz came in.
Jazz is really good for that.
Well, yeah. I mean, they had jazz audiences in Boston and Worcester, but we started bringing some great jazz players. You know, Diane Reeves came in. We had Cassandra Wilson come in.
I remember that.
Toots Thielemann, yeah, Kenny Werner. I can't remember all the names. There's been so many people coming. Mary McPartland.
It was incredible. It was a musical education at that point for me. Being in the station, I knew a little bit about jazz, mostly about a very certain, sort of late 40s into the beginning of the 60s jazz, which is what I listened to. But I found myself getting an entire musical education.
Me too.
For being just sitting around at the station doing something else.
Yeah. Well, of course, I was getting savvy too, as well as what to do with concerts. We still lost money on a few here and there.
Yeah, but that's to be accepted.
Well, yeah.
But it's tough for a non-commercial station.
It is tough, but... we kept on going with show after show after show. I wish I could think of all the names, but Karen Allison played there many times. Tierney Sutton played here many times.
Wow.
Renee Marie played. I mean, the list is long, and very proud of that. Most shows did well. They were mostly in Tuckerman Hall or Mechanics Hall, but then the Hanover Theater opens up, our neighbor across the street, and I thought even bigger. So we started, I brought in, first of all, the Glenn Miller Orchestra, which packed the place because no one was thinking of seniors. And then we brought in, who was it next? Jack Jones, of all things, with Count Basie. And then we brought in Chris Bode, and he packed the place as well. And then Dave Brubeck as well, which we brought in. So and Glenn Campbell.
And for people who are just like tuning into WISN now, it's like you sort of missed that golden age.
It was a golden age for
now,
us.
Now, there is a guest you brought in who I interviewed that nobody wants to talk about anymore.
Oh, yes.
Bill Cosby.
Yes, I knew it.
And I granted everything that's gone on, and it's horrible.
Yeah.
However, I had one of the best interviews. We did it, and he ended up not going on stage and stayed talking to me and talked all about the jazz musicians.
Well, I was with you at that one. I remember.
You were sitting right there.
Yeah, he kept on. He gave us, I think, 15 minutes, but we spent 2 hours talking about things, about jazz. He loved it. Meanwhile, the audience was in the
sitting
seats.
Sitting there
for probably at least a half hour, 45 minutes. They kept on saying, come on out. But he said, no, we're
going to
talk. All
I know is at one point he did an imitation of Fat Albert.
And yes,
I fell off the chair. It's so sad that we can't, and we have all those photographs too.
I know. We can't do
anything about that.
To his credit, though, you remember when we were finally gave up and walked upstairs. He walked in the green room behind the stage, and he had shorts on and a t-shirt, nothing, not dressed
right,
fancy.
Right,
he said,
right.
Thanks a lot. And he just turns and walks on the stage, the three steps on the stage. The crowd goes wild, and there he is. No practice, no rehearsal, no dress up, doing a show.
Of artists that you met, either from bringing them to concerts or they come down to the station and visit, what one surprised you the most? If I was to ask you, like,
well, in a broad state, I was so surprised how nice every single jazz artist was. They're
right.
Bright, intelligent, kind people. Every single one. The rock stars, not as much.
I know that.
You know,
remember,
but,
I was head of the rock department, and we had people that we would bring down the station who would kick a hole in the wall.
I think maybe it was David Crosby. We had Crosby and Nash come in, and David would just, I shouldn't even say these things, but he would go in the downstairs in the Green Room Mechanics Hall. He'd lay on the couch and ask every girl who's going by to lay with him and hang out with him and do things. And I'd tell him stories, and he'd exaggerate the stories to Graham Nash, and didn't say that, David. You know, it was on and on, but they were nice people.
Again, just be able to meet people like that.
Yeah. Oh, Graham came up to me and said, I'm putting this on. He said, Brian, I got the best band in the world for you right now. We're going to give you the best show you ever had tonight. And that was a stock line probably from all promoters. Then he went on his way. But when I told David about the history of Mechanics Hall, he was so enamored
right.
by what
yeah,
we
yeah.
had done. And he said, Graham, come listen to all this stuff. But, I mean, it was no shocking people. You know, a lot of people. Bill Wyman was fine, but he was, you know, protective. Linda Ronstadt was very fine, but very quiet, very private. The person I loved the most, I had a crush on, was Mary McPartland. She was the funniest, nicest woman. Everywhere I went, she remembered me, came out to see me, I mean, many, many times.
I covered a biography of
Mary McPartland.
She's
great.
And she sounds like she would have been an amazing person to get to know.
I can't tell you the stories because she's pretty sailor mouth, let's say. She had
I've heard that.
Behind the scenes, but funny. Funny woman and so interesting to talk to, you know. So we had these people here. She played right behind you in the piano right there.
And for people who don't know, have never been down to the station, we have a performance space.
Yeah.
And that jazz artists would come down and just play.
Yeah, well, Linda Ronstadt played there with her. And then we had, Kenny Rankin played there a lot.
Oh, man.
I mean, Grace Kelly a lot. I mean, I wish I could think of all the names. It just, place was packed with people.
I want to get to some nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
Okay, because I want to pick you. One of the things that you freak me out every time I sit down with you to do this, and this is going to sound funny.
Yeah.
Fundraising.
Oh, yeah.
On-air fundraising, which a lot of people dread.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the listeners dread.
Yeah.
But somehow, you've always managed to turn it around. I have never seen you fail. And it was freaky to me because I would go on with you.
Well, I know, but you have really helped me do a great job. You have the great energy.
Yeah, that's right. Now, what's your attitude towards fundraising when you're on?
Well, I've been in sales all my life in many
ways.
That
helps. I have to believe that helps.
So, you know, it helps. And the selling of building a business was really about getting people to buy into the concepts and stuff like that. So when I'm on the air, I loved the station. I loved what we did. So I had enthusiasm. And when I would teach people about sales, 75% of that success is enthusiasm. And I have it for the station. And I knew it so well. You know, we built this, so we knew what we had. So the key was to just talk to one person on the mic, and everyone thought I was talking to them, to make a personal connection and give them reason to give and give now.
It's your voice. I'm convinced it's your voice. Because I would write a check right now, like I said before.
Well, you can't. It won't help me any. Put Brian on it.
But it is amazing. You really sort of set a tone in fundraising, too.
Well, we wrote new scripts and new concepts how to do that.
That was new.
Yeah, that was new. But just we had to get a message across to people, because how do people really know what goes on and how much time is spent here? So when they turn on 90.5, there's music they like there. There's so much to it. So much energy, sometimes expense, all done by volunteers for the most part.
Oh, stop. You're already doing a pitch.
Yeah, sorry. I guess I am.
Well, you know, and that brings me to a point. Being in that position, general manager, what are the things that you wish the public listener knew about the station that most likely they don't?
Well, I think it's our intent to try to engage people who might be underserved musically on the radio. A lot of people don't know much about jazz at all, or think it's terribly honky, squeaky stuff.
Yeah.
So part of my idea was to bring in the music that people did like Dinah Krall, for example, or Jane Monheit or Dave Brubeck, and get a lot more of that, and then introduce them. But we spent most of my time was thinking about how do we connect with people? What do we do in the air to make them stay longer and like it and feel a part of this? Because really, they are the public in public radio. We're there for them, and we had to find out who they are and how we please them. I don't think they realize that how much time we spent on that, but not for the big popular stuff, but for somebody who's got a little more intellect, a little more experience in life, and might want a higher taste in music. And that's what we addressed to that. And we thought people would respond to that, and they have done well.
They have.
But yet only about 10% of our listeners actually give. Which I like to get into the other 90% somehow, but
you're always trying to crack that. I think everybody who goes on the air and fundraises is always trying to go, like, where is that other 90%?
Yeah.
And what does it take? And I've been on with you, and sometimes it's just one word or one phrase.
One thing, yeah.
And all of a sudden the phones light up.
Timing is one.
Timing is perfect.
Because a lot of people listen as tertiary. You
know, that's right.
So you get them at the right time. But if they realize the importance of public radio and our musical art forms, this is America's music in all forms, be it folk or soul, that could get lost out there with today's commercial elements in terms of pop music. It's all different. And I don't believe very good anymore. It's a product.
What do you think the effects are of satellite radio?
Well, just another way to get it, you know.
One of the things, and I just want to hear your opinion about this, there's less emphasis on the DJ, on the voice. Because it's whatever that music you want specifically. So it's all pigeonholed. And the DJs become secondary to the music.
Well, I'll give SiriusXM credit. Their DJs are excellent.
I listen to SiriusXM.
Yeah, the DJs are excellent. They're famous, often well-known.
And I've actually interviewed one of them.
Oh, have you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have it in my car. You know, I got a new car, so.
But what I see here in that you started here at WICN is we're like curators of music.
Yeah.
And we use that in fundraising, and I think people think we're just blowing, but we're not. I mean, there are people, I look at Tom Shaker as a good example.
Yeah.
That's a person who really gives a crap about what he's playing.
He's really great at what he does that and goes deep.
He goes deep. He goes real deep.
Very deep.
Very deep.
And we can do that as well because we're introducing local artists here and emerging artists, which don't get a chance even on SiriusXM per se. And we're kind of taste masters to find out, this is worth hearing. We get like maybe 20 CDs a day here, but probably only two might be worth playing. And we do this. So you've got the local element, you've got the passion of the person behind the mic who loves this music, and we're introducing things you hear nowhere else in this world. So for me, that's as best as we probably can do at this point without being on a satellite, I suppose.
It's funny, when I've thought back over the decades I've been at WICN, I have total affection for the station. Because there's something cool now at this point in time at being a non-commercial radio station.
Yeah.
And having the sort of ability to create stuff. Like you feel like you're really making stuff, putting sets together, doing that whole thing, doing an on-air personality. I don't know where else you could do that.
Not often. You know, we really play what we call authentic music
by
what we know to be great musicians. And you know, we don't get into the commercial stuff at all or all the beatbox and all that sort of thing. These are people who are true artists that really have, they can't get a record contract anymore, half these people, or get a concert date, but they are unbelievably good. So you hear them all the time. And I think most people realize how cool this is.
It's cool being here behind the mic.
I know. I loved it.
I know that.
35 like, years on the mic.
Although I still can't understand why you didn't ever do a British Invasion show.
We did.
We did one or two, three or four.
You didn't call me back, Mark.
those were like we could have easily filled 5 hours.
Anytime you want.
I know. What is the difficulty? What are the challenges? Let me put it that way, of managing an mostly volunteer staff.
Well, you know, ironically, volunteers were never a problem. I mean, they were so passionate and dedicated. The staff was always more difficult, I suppose, you know, because they're here every day and they had expectations of salaries or expectations of respect. And we try to do the best we could with all of that. But those are the real challenges. It's kind of funny, but another station in Boston, you know, well, it plays folk music. They finally went to a salary and they had a lot more trouble. The volunteers are a lot more easier from that. So the problem really was keeping staffing up there.
Once you get a salary, you always want more.
Yeah.
When you have nothing, well, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah, it's more fun doing it for free because you can walk away and, right, you know, right, whatever. Right, whatever. You know. But so I've did most of my time here for free as a volunteer. I spent 35 years here, but only 10 were the GM.
One of the things I always appreciated about you deeply is that you were aware of what was going on over the air. And I'll give an example. I'd come in early before I recorded an inquiry show. There wasn't a day that went by that you didn't come in, ask me who I was talking to, and then have a conversation with me about that.
Yeah.
That's not happened before or since. And so you were always on top of what, and it wasn't just me, it was everybody. You knew what was going on, which is why you had arguments about playlists.
yes.
But it was interesting. That seemed to me a critical thing. It's time consuming, but it was important for the staff.
Well, I think one of the important things is to make people feel like they're important here. I love what people do. I love what you did. I'm so proud to have you on the air during my time. And Tom Schick, all the people in the air, I loved what they're doing. And if I didn't, they wouldn't be here. But right. I was curious what they were doing, what they thought about it.
What?
So I always just ask everyone almost once a week, you know, how you feeling? How's your show going? Any challenges? Anything you can do to help? That kind of thing. And you always had new people. So I was always thrilled to hear what you do, because I think personally, you're one of the best interviewers on the air anywhere. I really believe that. You read the books.
I know,
you,
that's the thing. People,
nobody
I really do
that.
Read the books.
The whole book.
I know, the whole book with marginalia.
No, that's amazing what you do.
We only have a few minutes left. If I was to ask you what your top three high points, and I won't ask for the low points, but for the high points for your tenure here at the station, what would they be?
Well, certainly the move here and that first day to open the doors up and broadcast. That was a 3 or 4 year dream that we made come true. And, you know, all of a sudden things were good for ICN. The pressure was off. We were successful. I think being a friend of Mary McParland for a long time and loving her and finding out she would like to have Linda Ronstadt on and having Linda Ronstadt called me, ironically, because Wyatt Wade was a good friend, and became friends on the phone, put them two together here in Worcester, was an honor. And then it was a successful show. Everyone had a good time. It was a flagship show for NPR. And I thought that was magic to happen. It was so good. They all did it basically for free. It was wonderful. And perhaps bringing back Bill Wyman's Rhythm Kings, too.
Oh,
because
man.
That was, you know, the visit and the house day and all that was pretty good. But everyone I met, you know, was so cool. Toots Thielemann could be a nicer guy in the world. I loved his personality and sitting with him all night. Or Kenny with Rankin became a friend of me here. He would come all the time. This was his station in his town. You made friends, you know, of the artists. And they are very different than their music, but they're all great people. So to me, I can't beat it.
This is all against the background of there's a physical aspect to the radio station, too.
Yeah, it's a building.
And like you sort of, listeners probably tend to forget that, but there is a real sort of workaday. We have a lot of equipment here.
Oh.
What was that? Was that like always not a great thing to have to deal with?
Yeah, every day something failed. You know, CD player, we have 4 or 5 CD players running all the time, and always one or two would fail.
Well, it's like just imagine it happening in your house, you're keeping all your stuff on all the time.
Yeah.
The stuff is going to like break down.
The transmitter goes bad, ice on the.
Well, the transmitter, that's always an issue.
Yeah, you get these things, STLs they call it, and they freeze up with ice in a storm. You can't go up there and you can't broadcast. People don't show up at the last minute.
See, there's the ideal dealing with the artist, and then there's you're down in the weeds.
Constantly having some, yeah, always putting out fires every day, trying to build better ways to make it have less happen, which we did with new transmitters and backup transmitters, but new sites.
But everything gets old over time.
It's a vicious cycle. So you fix the old thing. It's
did
back
you
to the
imagine
new thing.
That WICN would still be here?
Yeah. I thought it would be here. Yeah.
Even after you left?
Yeah. I had left in a very good place. They had a lot of money. They had a good staff. There was nothing more to do besides just use someone else's imagination. Because there's a bell curve of time. I spent 10 years here. I had a lot of new ideas. And then it kind of flattens out.
Right.
My energy was dissipating. And I was getting offers for other places as well to work and do the same thing. So I thought, you know, maybe it's time. And somebody thought, yeah, well, they're all set. But it didn't quite work out that way.
No, it's okay now.
Yes, it is. They're doing a good job now.
We're good. We're yeah. good now. But yeah. When you left, that was a big hole.
Apparently, it was. Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, so it was sad to see that. I tried to change that, but I could only do so much.
That's right.
Yeah.
Are you ever going to come back and do an on-the-air at least show once?
Just like, a British Invasion show with you.
I'll do that any night.
All right.
British Invasion show with you is like my dream thing, and it's funny because I play a lot of hardcore punk and new wave stuff, but it's like you and jazz. It's like my. Somewhere in my heart, this thing for the British Invasion, I just got to give you a minute. What is it about the British Invasion you love so much?
Well, I think it's because when I was a young boy, I'd heard jazz a lot in my life. My father loved it. But all of a sudden, you know, I started hearing Robeson. I loved that. The radio, ORC, was on my radio all the time. And then all of a sudden, the Beatles hit. And I couldn't believe that sound. And so and that I just fell in love right there.
There was a whole culture thing.
Yeah, and the bands kept coming.
Oh,
culture
Freddie
thing.
And the Dreamers and the Dave Clark Five. And the list is endless.
And not high school. I was a high school age kid.
I was a high school age
kid.
So,
you know, that's perfect. So I locked
into
that.
There was this weird romanticism about Britain.
Yeah.
You watch these ads for Yardley Slickers, and it was like, wow.
Yardley. Yes. Yeah.
Hullabaloo, man.
Hullabaloo, Shindig.
Shindig, oh my God.
I was just living it a large here. We had good music live here in that town at the time, too.
That's right, that's right.
So, yeah, I got into it, and it's such a fond memory that I can't let go.
Well, with that, I'm going to say goodbye. My guest tonight has been the one and only Brian Barlow. He was general manager of WICN, bringing it really through to the modern era of the station and through some very critical years and some great experiences. And it's a done deal with the British Invasion show. Okay.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.